here at KGNU. Shelley Slender talks with anti-fluoridation activist Paul Connett, author of The Case Against Fluoride, How Hazardous Waste Ended Up in Our Drinking Water, and the Bad Science and Powerful Politics That Keep It There.
Paul Connett, you brought a book in here today called The Case Against Fluoride, How Hazardous Waste Ended Up in Our Drinking Water, and Bad Science and Powerful Politics.
Keep it. Yes, it's been a really frustrating issue for me. I've spent about 28 years working on waste management, so it's interesting. We've just passed EcoCycle here, and I'm writing a book on zero waste, and Eric Lombardi, who's the director of EcoCycle, has got a chapter in that book. So that's been most of my activist life, has been on waste management. But 17 years ago, my wife persuaded me to look at the fluoridation issue. And like many Americans, I thought the people opposed to fluoridation were a bunch of crazies. But when I started to read the literature, I was appalled. And one of the facts which persuaded me that this was a very silly thing to do, namely put fluoride in the drinking water, is because the level in mother's milk is so incredibly low. The level, to give you the numbers, 0.004 parts per million. So when you fluoridate at one part per million, this means a bottle-fed baby in a fluoridated community is getting about 200 times more fluoride than nature intended.
Let's pause there for just a minute to give some more context, because that is interesting. Yeah. I didn't even know that. That was an interesting detail. I ask people from Boulder County Public Health if they would be on at the same time as you, and they declined. Mm-hmm. And I asked a neighbor down the street who happens to be a public health expert in dentistry, if he would talk with me and, in fact, talk with you at the same time. And he declined to talk with you at the same time. And he, I have learned that public health people think that it's not productive for them to be in the same room at the same time with a debater.
Absolutely.
Some, and so they're not here because they were concerned that you, as somebody who is most up to date on the latest studies and debate and conversation technique, would make them look silly.
Well, you know, what makes them look silly is this is an undefendable practice. Many people in the public health chain of command are simply promoting and defending a policy that they don't question that policy. The policy is sent to them from above, unfortunately.
Well, it puts me in the space right now, though, Paul Connett, if you don't mind. Yeah. I need to be a devil's advocate.
That's fine. That's good.
All right. So I'm going to be a devil's advocate from the very start.
Okay.
I didn't know that there is less fluoride in mother's milk than there is in drinking water. But in a way, that might make sense because babies don't have teeth.
Who knows more about what the baby needs, Mother Nature or a bunch of dentists from Chicago? I put my money on Mother Nature every time.
Well, okay, so two sides of Mother Nature. I'm thinking now, if I was a young mother, that if I was feeding my baby formula, which, by the way, is not recommended, if possible, if someone can breastfeed, that's supposed to be more helpful to a baby.
Yeah.
But if somebody is using formula, I would think that filtered water would be the way to go, as long as my baby doesn't have teeth yet and I'm not feeding my baby things like apple juice and sticky cornflakes.
Well, what the public health authorities should be doing is to warn parents that they shouldn't be using fluoridated tap water to make up that formula. But they're not giving those warnings. They're not giving those warnings, even though they know. The one thing that they don't deny is that in that first year, you increase your risk of getting dental fluorosis. First year of exposure to fluoride increases your risk of getting dental fluorosis.
Let's talk about what dental fluorosis is, those little icky brown and yellow spots on someone's teeth.
Yeah, you should know all about that in Colorado, because the original name for this was Colorado brown or Colorado stain. Little white patches which, with the different levels of severity, cover more and more of the teeth. So very mild.
Very mild is just a discoloration of the teeth. From the way that this was found out, that there was this possibility of this stuff, is through natural fluoridation in water.
That's
right. So actually, it's possible to have fluoridated teeth because of water, and that's how dentists found out
that's right.
that fluoride in water hardens teeth and reduces cavities.
That's what they thought. The studies done, first of all, yes, it's absolutely true that systemically fluoride causes dental fluorosis. It's an interference with the biochemistry of laying down the tooth enamel.
At some levels, there is a debate and a thought that it hardens teeth. If it gets to be too much, then it puts little brown spots on teeth.
Yeah, and that's what we're finding. They thought when they started fluoridation, they would limit the number of kids with this condition to 10% in its very mild form. Now we have 41% of American children aged 12 to 15, and that's an average of those growing up in fluoridated and non-fluoridated communities. So it'd be higher in fluoridated communities with this condition, and not only in very mild. 8.6% have mild, which impacts 50% of the surface. 3.6% have moderate or severe, which impacts 100% of the tooth enamel.
The dental health public health expert who I spoke with said that his guess is that the most common reason that there is excess fluoride in a child's mouth is because a child has not learned how to brush properly, and so they swallow the sweet, foamy toothpaste that they're brushing with, mm-hmm. and a lot of toothpaste is fluoridated.
Yeah, what a pity that they've taken this discussion off the radar screen, because it's absolutely criminal, in my view, for toothpaste manufacturers to be selling toothpaste to children of 1,000 parts per million and then making it bubblegum flavor or banana flavor. You're encouraging children to swallow this stuff.
And this is, we're talking about the kind of toothpaste that is fluoridated. It is possible to find toothpaste that does not have fluoride in it.
Yeah. But the important thing here is that if you fluoridate a community, this is in addition to the fluoridated toothpaste. I don't know of any community that stopped telling people not to use fluoridated toothpaste because they fluoridated the water. So it's a total dose of fluoride which causes harm.
What the public health expert in dentistry told me is that he tries to educate communities to tell their children to spit the toothpaste out. Don't swallow it.
Yeah. You know, what's so intriguing, it's a pity that they won't come on the same platform with me and defend their position in public. But what's so irritating here is that there's no known process in the body that requires fluoride, not one bit of biochemistry in the human body that requires fluoride. And even the other side now admit that it works topically. So why on earth are we forcing people to swallow something when it works topically? If you want fluoride, brush it on your teeth and spit it out. But don't expose every single person to fluoride with every single glass of water, cup of coffee, beverages made in fluoridated communities that they drink.
Well, I heard an argument from the public health people about why it anyway.
Yeah. Well, why do it then? Why do they say you have to swallow it when it works topically?
And we're not talking about swallowing toothpaste. Nobody
wants
to have that. This is swallowing fluoride.
Yeah.
You already know the argument. You've heard it many times. So tell me, what is the reason, what is the rationale for fluoridating our water?
Well, I think they started this process so long ago and so many reputations have been sunk into it that they don't know how to stop. As Bill Hersey of the EPA, formerly with the EPA, toxic specialist there, said they're riding a tiger and they don't know how to get off.
Back to the people who did not want to debate you. What they told me, what I was told, is that right now cavities are on the rise in the United States. It's very clearly a issue of basically diet. The kinds of foods that we eat today are the kinds that promote dental cavities.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are many people who cannot afford to have a visit to the dentist.
Yeah.
And so when you have people like that, there is a lot of empirical evidence that indicates that there are fewer cavities. It's not like you get rid of cavities with fluoridated water,
no.
But there are fewer of them if kids and adults have fluoride in the water. And for people who can't afford dentistry, this is a way to reduce their cavities.
Well, it's unfortunate. 80% of dentists in this country will not treat children on Medicaid. That's what we need to put right. And the ADA refuses to allow a dental therapist to do basic help in clinics in low-income areas. They've opposed the use of dental therapists to do some of these basic things. So I think it's crocodile tears when we argue that we are doing this for the poor. If there are other ways ways that we can help families of low income without poisoning them.
What I heard from the dental public health person is that the biggest poison is probably how people eat, and that if you were able to change dietary policy and encourage more people to reduce the sugar in their diets and brush 20 minutes after somebody has a meal of Wheaties or some other kind of sticky food that turns into sugar on the teeth, then we wouldn't have all these cavities.
Yeah, that's right. We need education, not fluoridation. We need education for better diet, especially in low-income families. We should be putting our efforts into getting free toothbrushes and free toothpaste to people that can't afford it. We should be looking into the use of xylitol. Xylitol is a natural sugar which we make in our own bodies every day.
Now, Paul Conant, that's also a product that someone can buy. Do you have any financial ties to xylitol?
I have no financial ties to anybody. All my work is pro bono. But xylitol prevents the bacteria that convert the sugar to acids, which then attack the enamel. It prevents them from surviving in the mouth because they can't stick to, with xylitol in the mouth, they can't stick to the teeth. And it not only protects the adult, but if you give it to the mother, if the mother uses xylitol toothpaste, it protects the baby from that mouth-to-mouth contact, the licking of the teats, the kissing of the baby. This is how the bacteria from the mother gets into the baby's mouth.
And in fact, that is something that the dental health, public health people told me is a big issue, is that it's the bacterial community in the mouth of Americans that is basically pathological to teeth. Mm-hmm. And so it starts at a very early age.
Yes.
Because the microbes in one person's mouth pass to another person.
So if we could get off this nonsense of forcing people that don't want it to drink fluoride in their water, we could sit down with these people. We're all interested in helping get better health for our communities. And I think if you combine two things, sugar does two things. Sugar gives us tooth decay and sugar gives us obesity. It's going to cost this country billions and billions of dollars treating the ramifications of obesity in our teens. Everybody knows that. If we then take the effort to fight obesity and put it together with tooth decay and put this emphasis on better education for better diet, more vegetables, particularly, one lesson I would say is eat vegetables. Pregnant women, eat vegetables, as many as you can eat.
Do you mean corn? Corn's a vegetable.
Anyway,
You're laughing, but I'm serious about that question.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are things.
But you see, corn is also one of the big culprits in tooth decay because corn is something
high fructose syrup and stuff.
High fructose syrup, when corn is turned into chips, it makes as much sugar in the mouth as just about anything.
Yeah.
So when you say eat vegetables.
Yeah.
Can you be a bit more specific?
Yeah, fresh vegetables, yeah.
Or do you mean green leafy vegetables?
Yeah.
Or what are you talking about here?
I'm talking about the tomatoes, lettuce, cabbage, broccoli. Yeah, the green vegetables in particular, the green vegetables, yeah.
But you see, the other thing that I'm noticing, again, I'm supposed to be a devil's advocate here, is that it was a quick conversation about vegetables that we just had.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if we're talking about fluoridation or non-fluoridation, the public health expert who I talked with did indicate that his sense is that it's the cheapest way to at least reduce some cavities because it's kind of hopeless to get people to change how they eat. And in terms of how you've talked here, if you agree that the biggest culprit is what we're eating, that seems to be an issue that should be given more time.
Absolutely. Education, not fluoridation. There's a double standard here. On the one hand, you told me earlier that you have to educate parents about swallowing toothpaste and the bubblegum flavor. And on the other hand, we have to fluoridate because we can't educate parents. Now, which is it?
Speaking as the public health expert here, or the voice of a public health expert, what I was told is that dentists feel that they spend all of their time talking about diet to people, and people get really tired of hearing it. And so that makes, if you want people to come in for an appointment, they're not going to want to listen to you tell them what to eat while you're being told what to floss.
Yeah, but this doesn't mean that you latch on to mythology. Look, the science says the difference between the tooth decay between a child that's always grown up in a fluoridated community and a child that's grown up in a non-fluoridated community is minuscule. That's their own studies. Their own studies show that fluoridation, swallowing fluoride, does not reduce tooth decay.
And by how much are we talking about a change? Because that's a number that I will double-check with the health officials, because there is a chance that there are studies that say one thing and others that say another, and who's using what study?
Okay, I'm going to use their study. This is the largest survey of tooth decay ever undertaken in the United States. It was done in the years 86 to 87. It was reported in 1990 by Brunel and Carlos, and it was done by the National Institute for Dental Research, which is pro-fluoridation. They wanted to show once and for all that fluoridation worked. What they found is that if a child grew up in a non-fluoridated area, there was a 0.6 difference of one tooth surface, a saving, the average saving of children from 5 to 17 was a saving of 0.6 of one tooth surface out of over 100 tooth surfaces in a child's mouth, and they didn't even show that that was statistically significant.
Now, I was expecting you to say a 0.06 or 0.6 difference in number of cavities, but you just said tooth surface. How does that translate into cavities?
They measure that as decayed, missing, and filled surfaces. That's the way, there's two ways of measuring tooth decay in the official research literature. One is decayed, missing, and filled teeth, but decayed, missing, and filled surfaces is more sensitive because there are four or five surfaces to each tooth.
So it's a way to say cavities, basically.
Yes, it's a way to say cavity. So this minuscule saving. Now that was published in 1990. We have a more recent study, again, U.S. government funded study, the Iowa study, Warren and Workers, 2009. This Iowa study. They've been tracking children's tooth decay for years. And what they did in this case is they set out to find out what the optimal level of fluoride dose would be to reduce tooth decay. So they actually estimated or measured how much fluoride each of the children in this study was getting each day from water, from food, and from swallowing toothpaste. And they calculated that in milligrams per day. And then, to much to their dismay, they found that there was no relationship between the amount of fluoride swallowed and tooth decay in their study.
It's my impression that someone can get too much fluoride and then it doesn't really help your teeth. They do get harder, but there's other weird things that start to happen. Did they have any graph that showed at some point the fluoride became more effective?
No. They could not demonstrate what they set out to do, to demonstrate the optimal level of fluoride. And the end result was they said we should stop talking about the so-called optimal level of fluoride because we cannot define it. The only relationship, which is very clear in their data and everybody else's, that the more fluoride that you have before your permanent teeth have erupted, the more dental fluorosis that you get.
Dental fluorosis, again, is those spots on your teeth.
That's right.
And the issue that we're talking about is what happens before you even have teeth.
Yeah, exactly. What happens to the baby's brain? What's happening to its bones? What's happening to its developing tissues? The only thing that they will admit is what they can't deny, which is that you can see this disfigurement of the enamel, this blotching or mottling of the enamel surface. They don't deny that. But the gamble that we took in 1950, when the U.S. Public Health Service endorsed fluoridation, with none of the trials completed and with no substantial health data on the table, was that you could give this condition to a baby or to a child, dental fluorosis, without damaging any other tissue. And I think that's a reckless, reckless decision to have taken.
Before we go to the possibility that fluoride might damage other tissues, again, we have talked about how one option to still fluoridate water is to recommend that if somebody is using formula that they use filtered water.
Yeah, they use, well, make sure there's a bottled water or distilled water or some water with low fluoride in it. And that's not always easy to determine because they don't give you the fluoride levels in the United States. In Canada, they do. In Europe, they do. Bottled water has all the elements, ions that are present, but not in the United States. We fly blind on what water we drink.
All right, so check mark on if someone has a baby and they are feeding that baby formula. Perhaps you should check to see what kind of fluoride level is in the water. Mm. Now let's go to this issue of, does fluoride do anything besides cause little dots on your teeth if you have too much of it? What about other tissues?
Well, we've got concerns about the brain. We've got concerns about the thyroid gland. We've got concerns about the pineal gland. And we certainly got concerns about the bones and possibly the kidney. We now have 36 studies which shows a lowering of IQ in when you compare high fluoride villages and low fluoride villages, where it's naturally occurring in India and China and parts of Mexico and Iran. 36 studies. We're not attempting to do those studies in the United States. We're not doing the health studies in the United States that we should be doing.
In other words, in the United States, we don't have studies to look at fluoride in long-term use and safety for tissues. But on the other hand, it's been used in the United States for, what, 50, 60 years?
Yeah. And so the attitude is, look, if it was going to cause harm, we would know about it by now. Absolute poppycock. That's not the way you do science. If you don't look, you don't find. The absence of study is not the same as the absence of harm. You would not know if you were shaving off a few IQ points of the American population unless you did the studies to check. How do we know that the huge epidemic that we have in arthritis is not contributed to by people drinking fluoridated water all their lives, since the first symptoms of fluoride's damage to the bone is identical to arthritis? How do we know that the millions of people that have hypothyroidism in this country is not due in part to the fluoride that they're drinking in their water? We're not doing those studies.
All right, again, I promised that I would help the public health people who did not want to talk to a debater.
No.
Talked with you.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the India studies. You mentioned that those studies have not been done in the United States. In a study which looks for what causes something, there are a lot of variables. And we don't know whether in a village that has more fluoride, they also eat more candy. We don't know something like that.
Yeah, we don't know all those things. And precisely, that's exactly the same qualifications that you should apply to those studies that claim there's a benefit from fluoridation, because they don't often do not control for income levels, do not control for any delayed eruption in the teeth, do not control for other aspects of diet. But yes, but this kind of discussion should have been going on years ago. These are not excuses for not doing the science. It's their policy. It's not my policy.
It's not your policy.
No.
It's their policy, but I'll bet
they should be making sure that their policy is not harming millions of people. Over 200 million people are getting fluoridated water every day of their lives in this country, and they're not studying to see if it is causing harm, and they're ignoring the studies in other countries which are finding harm at natural levels.
Even at natural levels, you say that there are studies in these countries that show that IQ tends to be lower in places where the natural fluoride is higher.
Yeah.
So if those studies have not been done in the United States, and again, you agree that there's a chance that those villages where the fluoride is higher might also have more candy that they eat, or there might be more lead or something like that hasn't been looked at.
Okay. Well, I had the good fortune of going to two of the villages where one of these studies was done by Zhang in 2003. And I went a few years after that. I went to those two villages. First of all, these villages are very stable. They haven't moved for centuries. They have all the same lifestyle. They have the same occupation. They're rural farmers, have the same schooling, everything, the same diet, everything that you can think of, they had the same. And they controlled for lead exposure. They controlled for iodine exposure. They controlled for social factors. And even so, they found a 5 to 10 IQ point difference and a shift in the IQ curve between the village at 2.5 to 4.5 parts per million and the village at less than 0.7 parts per million. There was this shift in IQ, and he estimated, Zhang estimates, that the threshold for this change is 1.9 parts per million. That offers no margin of safety to protect all of America's children.
You're implying that even before those little brown spots appear on someone's teeth, which in the United States is the indication that a child has had too much fluoride or an adult has, in the United States that's considered a cosmetic problem with no other harm caused.
That's politics.
You're saying
that's politics. You're working backwards. They are working backwards for some need, and they have to explain what this need is to protect this practice, despite the fact the science says it doesn't work to swallow fluoride, despite the fact that there are problems. They're working backwards. And so it's very convenient to take the one issue that they've studied, namely dental fluorosis, and classify that as a cosmetic effect rather than doing the rational things to say, this is a red flag. This is telling us that our children are being overexposed to fluoride. 41% of American children, 12 to 15 in this country, have got some form of dental fluorosis. 8.6% with mild dental fluorosis, 3.6% either moderate or severe dental fluorosis impacting 100% of the enamel.
Do I have any of those spots on my teeth?
I can't. I'll have to put my glasses on.
How do you tell if you have this?
I think you might have the opaque patches. I would say that you have very mild dental fluorosis.
Well, just think, I'd be 10 points brighter if what you're saying is...
I don't think you could make these simplistic associations. You know, you can't argue from one individual. But on a population level, you know, these IQ studies have just been subjected to a meta-analysis by a team from Harvard University, including Philip Grandjean. And this was published in Environmental Health Perspectives, the leading journal for environmental health in the world, last July, July 2012. And they found an average lowering of IQ of 7 IQ points in these 27 studies they looked at. Now, they admitted there were weaknesses in the study, but they also said the results are remarkably consistent. We need to do more research to clarify that. But, of course, we've got no indication that in the United States we're going to do that research.
Speaking of research, though, you've indicated some other possible damages of too much fluoride, such as an impairment of thyroid function, an impairment of the kidneys, also an impairment of proper resiliency in the bones.
Yeah.
Now, if those kind of issues have happened, I can imagine that there have been studies in the United States about that. Am I correct?
Yeah. There have been studies on hip fracture, and the results are mixed. There are about the same number of studies which indicate that people drinking fluoridated water all their lives have an increase in hip fracture, and those have found no increase in hip fracture. There was a very significant study, again done in China, but by an American group, Lee and co-workers, in 2001, where they found a linear increase in hip fracture as the levels of fluoride in the water of these elderly villagers went above one part per million. A doubling at 1.5 parts per million, a tripling at 4 parts per million. Now, admittedly, the doubling at 1.5 parts per million in the hip fractures was not statistically significant. But what is striking is it looks like, if you look at all the data, it looks like a linear trend. As the level of fluoride in the water went above one part per million, you get this increase in hip fractures. But going back to the IQ for a moment, Philip Grandjean has just written a book on this, the whole business of exposing kids to neurotoxins. He's called it Only One Chance. In other words, the impact that you have on a child's brain when there are babies, when they're infants, is irreversible. That whatever IQ you lose in these early years sticks with you the rest of your life. And what he points out is the impact on the population as a whole that you have to be concerned of. So if you get a shift of, say, 5 IQ points, the average child is only going to go from 100 to 95 on the IQ scale. A parent wouldn't notice the difference between those two kids. A teacher wouldn't notice the difference between two kids. And that's what I mean about you have to do careful studies. But if you were to shift the IQ over by 5 IQ points, which we think we did when we had lead in gasoline, The end result is you halve the number of very bright or geniuses in your society, and you double the number of mentally handicapped. That has huge economic and social ramifications.
Agreed. That does have huge ramifications, and yet we should probably point out that we're discussing some possibilities of stuff that has not been totally validated. You mentioned a Harvard study. You've mentioned some studies in India, but it isn't the consensus yet.
It isn't the consensus because we are not doing those studies. These studies started to come out in 1991. The National Research Council reviewed these studies, five of these studies, in 2006 and said we need to do more research. I mean, it's so cavalier in my mind. I mean, the benefits, I've told you, their studies indicate there's little benefit from swallowing fluoride. This is something that we can end as easy as turning off a tap at the waterworks. And to mess around with the IQ, I think, absolutely irresponsible. It's even the precautionary principle at this point should be applied.
Paul Conant, if somebody wants to have fluoride out of their water and their city has fluoride in the water, what kind of filter do you put on your tap to keep it out?
Doesn't do any good. The cheap filters do not work. The charcoal filters, Brita filters, don't work. You need either reverse osmosis, which is expensive, or distillation, which is also expensive, or ion exchange, very expensive. Even when you've done all that, you're not protecting yourself from your showers, from your baths. You're still using this fluoridated water on your vegetables in your garden. And every time you go downtown, every time you go to work, you're still going to be drinking fluoridated water.
And when we talk about the fluoridated water, how about if you get bottled water? How do you tell if that has fluoride in it?
Well, you have to check with the manufacturer. Ring up the 800 number and ask them what the level of fluoride is. And if that doesn't work, then get it tested. If you're going to use bulk supplies from the same places, which is what we did before we got fluoridation out of Canton, New York, where I lived for 30 years, we used to get the big 5-gallon containers of water. We would put on a water tower, and we used that for cooking and drinking.
Now, Paul Conant, you got fluoride out of Canton, New York,
yes,
your city. What has happened to the levels of cavities among the whole population and among people who can't afford to go to the dentist?
Yeah, they haven't done any studies on that. But we do have studies of what happened when they stopped fluoridation in former East Germany, in Finland, in British Columbia, and in Cuba. And much to the surprise of the researchers, they found that tooth decay did not go up. In fact, it continued to do the decrease that we're seeing. You know, most countries...
We're seeing a decrease in tooth decay?
Absolutely. Throughout the world. You're seeing it throughout the world. If you look at the World Health Organization data, which they've collected for years now since the 1960s in umpteen different countries, they found that tooth decay has been coming down from the 60s through the 90s, and it sort of plateaued off at a very low level. And you cannot tell the difference between the rates of decline, whether the country is fluoridated or non-fluoridated.
What do you assume is the reason for the decline in tooth decay around the world?
I think there's several factors. One is increased standard of living. With that goes better diet, more refrigeration, more fresh food, more cheese, etc.
Is cheese something that tends to reduce cavities?
Yeah. More education.
Does it matter whether it's high-fat or low-fat cheese?
I don't know the answer to that. And also the general availability of fluoridated toothpaste. We've already said that if fluoride works, it works topically. With the universal availability of this method of applying fluoride to the teeth, why should you expect a greater reduction in tooth decay in communities which are fluoridated when it works topically?
Are you guessing that perhaps the technology of putting fluoride in toothpaste is superior to putting it in our water?
I think it's far more rational. If it has a topical effect and the organ that you're trying to treat is available to you, why swallow the stuff? Why expose every tissue in the body to a known toxic substance when you can apply it to the one tissue that needs it and then spit it out afterwards? And why force it on people that don't want it when anybody that wants fluoride can go out and buy fluoridated, most people doing it anyway, and brush it on their teeth and spitting it out? And especially when you see that if you look at tooth decay in 12-year-olds, which the World Health Organization is doing for all these countries, the countries which don't fluoridate, their teeth are just as good as those that do. 97%, let me just stress this, 97% of the population of Europe does not drink fluoridated water.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.